We're continuing tonight our series on overlooked books of the Bible. We've studied from the book of Leviticus already and from the book of Ruth a couple of weeks ago. And so we're going to continue that study tonight by tackling one of the hardest books in the Bible. And it is a book that is overlooked, most likely because it is very hard to understand. It's a difficult book. It's written in language that we don't use today. It's also overlooked, I believe, because it seems to be overtly sexual, and that makes us uncomfortable. And it's also overlooked, I think, because there are some odd interpretations that are given to this book. We'll talk about that as we go through. But sometimes when we put all those things together, it just makes for a book that we just sort of stay away from. We're talking about the book, The Song of Solomon. And I hope that you'll be turning over to that book so that we can study from it together and learn what the Bible has to teach us in this part. Now, I want to remind you something we probably know, but I feel needs to be said in this discussion. The Bible is always worth our time. And the Bible is never lewd. So what we're reading tonight, though it may seem to be a little lewd to you, what that means is we just need to readjust what we believe is lewd. Because obviously if God is saying this, we're not going to be better than God in terms of morality. He's saying this is something that is appropriate in its context. So we need to just put that thought aside and study from God's Word together. We'll start tonight with an overview of what I believe this book is teaching. I believe the Song of Solomon tells the story of King Solomon finding, getting to know, marrying, and maturing with a special woman. She is called the Shulamite. And in this book, we read some vivid descriptions of the romance of these two people, some sexual encounters they have once they are married, and even some of their marital struggles. Let's start by reading in Song 1 and verse 1. It says, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, may he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. For your love is better than wine. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. Therefore the maidens love you. Draw me after you and let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will rejoice in you and be glad. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you." You may have noticed I'm reading from a different version than I normally do. This is from the New American Standard Version, which I believe has a little bit better rendering in some places in the song. So I thought I'd just read from this version. Hope that doesn't confuse you tonight. But what we see in this first section is an identification of the author of the song. It is Solomon's song in verse 1, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And we're also introduced to several features in this first little tidbit. We see that the main idea of the song is love. It says there in verse 2, "May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." Love will be the subject, beginning and end, of the Song of Solomon. We also see that there is a poetic form that this song takes. It's not a narrative. And there's lots of imagery in this poetic form. And we need to be a little careful with all the different images because they're not always used to tell a story as much as they are to express a thought. For example, in verse 3 it says, "Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. Therefore the maidens love you." You see, there is a certain sense in which this is a picture and not really anything about oil in itself. But oil is used to describe the pleasantness, the nice association people have with the beloved that this woman is speaking of. We see here also that there are different people speaking. You have in verse 1, no one seems to be speaking, but then the lady, the Shulamite woman, begins to speak, verses 2 to 4. And then in the end of verse 4, it says, "We will rejoice in you and be glad. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you." This identifies another group, probably the one that is identified later in the book as the daughters of Jerusalem. So what you see is it's sort of like we've got a play. We've got certain people talking, and then there are other characters who come in and come out. But, and this is the important thing, we don't have the names. We don't know which one is which. And so that leads to a lot of different interpretations of the book. There are some who don't think this is just about the Shulamite and Solomon, as I do, but they believe there is a love triangle. where there is a shepherd boy who is the true love of the Shulamite, and Solomon has come to take the Shulamite away, but she ultimately spurns Solomon to be with a shepherd boy. Now, I've got a lot of problems with that interpretation, and we're going to look at those as we go through. But the other major interpretation of the book that I want to mention here at the outset is that the book is speaking of the relationship between Christ and the church. And there are a whole host of religious authors who put Solomon as Christ and the Shulamite as his church. And the objection I have to this, well, for one, we're never told anywhere that this is speaking of Christ and the church. It's sort of a guess as to what we make of this. There is no other Old Testament book that's even close to this in terms of speaking explicitly about the church. But the main objection I have is the love that Christ and His church have for one another is not physical and it's not sexual. And if we apply that consistently, it makes this book say some very silly things. And we'll see that and demonstrate that as we go along. But verse 4 of chapter 1 says, "Draw me after you and let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers." She says, "Let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers." Solomon has called for this young woman, brought her into his palace. I don't think we're talking here about his bed chambers as much as his tent. Brought me into his company. In the second part, the daughters of Jerusalem speak. That sets us in Jerusalem. One of the major problems with the triangle view that says there's a shepherd boy involved is that the setting is all wrong. She's not with Solomon, she's not in his chambers if she's running around behind his back with the shepherd boy. But this sets us in Jerusalem. Verse 5 says, "I am black but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am swarthy, for the sun has burned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyards, but I have not taken care of my own vineyard." Here the Shulamite is self-conscious about being in such a public position. She is obviously not royalty. She's not used to this treatment, and she says, "Don't stare at me because I am black." She says there at the end of verse 6, "They may be caretaker of the vineyards, but I have not taken care of my own vineyard." She probably refers to her appearance. "I haven't taken care of myself, taking care of everything else and everyone else but not myself. So don't stare at me." Verse 7, "Tell me, O you whom my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock? Where do you make it lie down at noon? For why should I be like the one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? If you yourself do not know, most beautiful among women, go forth on the trail of the flock and pasture your young goats by the tents of the shepherds." One of the major objections of the people who teach the triangle theory here is that Solomon was not a shepherd. He was a prince, they say. Now, I'll just say in defense of what I believe this is teaching, we do know that Solomon had flocks. Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 7 tells us that. Perhaps he liked to keep them. We know Saul did that even after he became king with oxen. Probably a good thing, they think, to get out of the palace and to do something active. But it seems more likely to me that when we talk about the shepherd and where do you pasture your flock, it seems more likely to me these are poetic images, just like other images in the book about her hair being like a flock of goats. I'm sorry, her teeth being like a flock of goats and things like that. It's not exactly corresponding to a reality as much as it is expressive of something they want to convey to one another. Perhaps this is just playful banter between two lovers. This is the way they play with one another. They talk about being a shepherd and seeking the shepherd with his sheep. But regardless, in verse 9 it says, "To me, my darling, you are like my mare among the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with the strings of beads." So Solomon reassures her about her insecurities. She's worried about her appearance. She's worried about her dark skin. And he says, you are beautiful, you are fair. In verse 12, "While the king was at his table, my perfume gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me a pouch of myrrh, which lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi." So she sits with Solomon at his table, and she's thinking about wanting to be with him. She's dreaming about it. She's thinking about how marvelous he is to her and how pleasant he is to her. In verse 15, he says, "How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves." And she says, verse 16, "How handsome you are, my beloved, and so pleasant. Indeed, our couch is luxuriant. The beams of our houses are cedars, our rafters, cypresses." So they compliment each other. Now, those who teach the triangle theory say the Shulamite loved her beloved deeply, while Solomon was only physical in his attraction. But what we see here is, he compliments her, "You are beautiful." She compliments him, "You are handsome." So this passage shows us they are mutually attracted. And the Shulamite is physically attracted to her beloved. The king, by the way, is the only man in this setting. Back in verse 12, the king at his table. In chapter 2, in verse 4, it says, "He has brought me to his banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. Sustain me with raisin cakes, refresh me with apples, because I am lovesick. Let his left hand be under my head, and his right hand embrace me." Here they're getting to know one another better. They go to the banqueting house together as Solomon courts her. They are falling in love. She is lovesick, it says in verse 5. Excuse me. "His banner over me is love," she says in verse 4. Now, it seems more likely that Solomon would have the banquet house than the beloved. The shepherd boy. In verse 6 it says, "Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me." Perhaps she's imagining him holding her, or perhaps he really is. But I want you to notice something. Look at verse 7. She says, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases." She stops herself. She says, "Don't stir up love until it is time." Now, this is a very important little section, because each time that it seems things are getting a little too hot and heavy between these two young lovers, she stops herself and says, "It's not time yet for that." When she begins to imagine, or perhaps really is going through this with Solomon, thinking about him holding her, thinking about them being together, she says, "Stop. Stop. It's not time for that yet. Do not awaken love." They aren't married yet, and things are heating up a little too fast. So verse 8, "Listen, my beloved. Behold, he is coming, climbing on the mountains, leaping on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he is standing behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. He is peering through the lattice. My beloved responded and said to me, 'Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. For behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers have already appeared in the land, the time has arrived for pruning the vines, and the voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened its figs, and the vines in blossom have given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along.'" So Solomon comes bounding in with the joy and energy of young love. "Come on, let's go, get up, let's run away together." They've waited, the spring is here. Perhaps we have an image here of their relationship growing toward fruition. But again, verse 17, she says, "Until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of Bethel." So not yet, not until the day breaks. Turn away, go away. We'll come back to that, by the way, in just a few minutes as we look further in the song. But she says, "Turn and go away for the moment." In chapter 3, in verse 1, it says, "On my bed, night after night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him. I must arise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me, and I said, 'Have you seen him whom my soul loves?' Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him, and I would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases." So here, the Shulamite has a terrible dream where she cannot find her beloved. She goes around the city seeking him, the watchman help her, and then she finds him and she says, I would not let him go. She said, I brought him into the house of my mother and into her room and wait. She says again, don't stir up love until it's time. This dream that seems to be sort of a haze now seems to be heating up as she thinks about bringing her beloved home and where that might lead. And so she says again, stop, it's not time. In chapter 3 and verse 6 it says, what is this coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant? Behold, it is the traveling couch of Solomon, 60 mighty men around it, of the mighty men of Israel. All of them are wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. King Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, and its seat of purple fabric, with its interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon with the crown with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart. It is the day of Solomon's wedding. Finally, the time has come. Look at his amazing wedding party, they say. Look at all the traveling couch. Look at all the people. Look at the gold and the beauty, the crown that he has on the day of his wedding. This is definitely Solomon's wedding. Because not only does it mention that in verse 11, the day of his wedding, but after this point, he is going to refer to the Shulamite as my bride or my spouse. Before she was my darling. Now she is my wife. So they're going to be married. And the next picture, the next scene that we see is of their wedding night in chapter 4. This is the time in which all the buildup of their courtship will be satisfied. Chapter 4 and verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Notice she's wearing a veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost their young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples are like a slice of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones, on which are hung 1,000 shields, and all the round shields of the mighty men. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. Until the cool of the day, when the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. Solomon compliments his wife from top to bottom. Now, these comparisons seem odd to us, don't they? I don't know many women who would appreciate something like your hair is like a flock of goats. But even so, these comparisons are accentuating how attracted he is to every part of her. He's willing to express that by complimenting her and comparing her to the most marvelous things that he can. Now, this text illustrates how awkward it is to interpret this book as Christ's love for his church. If this is talking about Jesus and the church, what does it mean? Well, I was curious as to what some who teach this think this means, and so I looked it up, and I'll tell you what one commentator said. He said, the Shulamite's eyes are preachers, her hair are the members of the church, her teeth are also preachers, her lips are her prayers, her temples, which Solomon says are like a pomegranate, they are its ecclesiastical officers. I'm not exactly sure what that means. Her neck is either preachers or the Bible. And her breasts are either preachers or they are one the Old Testament and the other the New Testament. Seriously, that's what he says. Do you see how we're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole? This doesn't work. So that's not what this text is teaching. That's not what Solomon, he's not giving us some comparison of Christ and the church. He's simply complimenting his new bride. In verse 9, You have made my heart beat faster, my sister, my bride. You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of the oil than all kinds of spices. They are married. She is now his bride. In verse 12, it says, a garden locked is my sister, my bride. A rock garden locked. A spring sealed up. She is a garden enclosed, he says. She is a garden, a spring shut up, a fountain that is sealed. What this means is she was sexually pure before marriage. It's as if her body has been locked. Only now will she open the garden and let her husband enter and enjoy the fruits of her body. So it says in verse 16, awake, O north wind, and come wind of the south. Make my garden, this is the Shulamite speaking, make my garden breathe out fragrance. Let its spices be wafted abroad. May my beloved come into his garden and eat its choice fruits. So let my beloved come in and eat its fruits. She says, I've saved myself for marriage, but now is the time when this is what should be. And so in chapter 5 and verse 1, he says, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh along with my balsam. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. And then this comment, eat, friends, drink and imbibe deeply, O lovers. So he says, looking back now, I have come into my garden. Notice all the my's here. He says, it's my garden, my sister, my bride. It's my myrrh and my balsam, my honeycomb, my wine and my milk. He truly viewed his wife as his now. They belong to one another. And the comment at the end of verse 1, eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers. I take this as God speaking his approval. God is saying, this is my intention for marriage, where two people can enjoy one another in a sexual way. And it is a beautiful thing that God here signs his approval onto. Now, honestly, I do not know how anyone can read this text and ignore the obvious sexual references here. To teach about a shepherd boy as some other character that I don't see in the text, to teach that means that either she had sex with Solomon here in an unwilling state, or that she had sex with a shepherd boy outside of marriage. So either she is a fornicator with the shepherd boy, or she's married to Solomon and then decides to leave him for another man, according to that interpretation. So to me, that's a death blow for that interpretation. It's very clear here, the images and the pictures are talking about sexual contact. And to deny that really is to deny the clear teaching of this. So that seems to me to be the end of that interpretation. Let's look in chapter 5 now in verse 2. Here is where the story after the wedding night, after the honeymoon, begins to change a little bit. And we'll probably connect with this when we think about the marriages that we have and how things aren't always great forever, happily ever after in a marriage. Chapter 5 and verse 2 says, I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice. My beloved was knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. She speaks. I have taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I dirty them again? My beloved extended his hand through the opening, and my feelings were aroused for him. I rose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and had gone. My heart went out to him as he spoke. I searched for him, but I did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer me. The watchmen who make the rounds of the city found me. They struck me and wounded me. The guardsmen of the walls took away my shawl from me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him, for I am lovesick. This is a new scene long after the wedding night. And her beloved, her husband, comes to the door calling for her, but she doesn't want to get up. Verse 3 says, I've taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I've washed my feet. How can I dirty them again? These are the frustrated questions of interrupted sleep that I believe we've all experienced. So she realizes who it is and what she's done, and she gets up to let him in, but he's gone. And now her heart yearns for him. She's upset by what she's done, and she goes after him. The watchman beat her before taking off her veil and realizing who she is. Perhaps this represents how others must have berated her treatment of her husband. How disapproving they were of what she had done. But it's not just happily ever after in a marriage, is it? We have problems. Especially we have problems that are caused by selfishness in one party or both. So what she does is she begins to recite how wonderful her husband is. That's in verse 10 to 16 of chapter 5. And when she finds her husband again, he seems to have forgotten all about it. Everything seems to be okay, and they are reunited. In chapter 6 and verse 4, he says, "You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my darling, as lovely as Jerusalem, as awesome as an army with banners. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have confused me. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Gilead." I want you to especially notice verse 8 and 9. Verse 8 says, "There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. She is her mother's only daughter. She is the pure child of the one who bore her. The maidens saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines also, and they praised her." Solomon had a lot of wives, but he says, this one is the one. The special one to him. She is unique. This is another complaint against the beloved being Solomon. Some say, how can a man with so many wives have loved one wife like this? Well, that's exactly what he says here. He says, you're far better than all the rest of me. Now, I don't know how they worked that out, but they did. And you can see that they had a tremendous relationship despite the presence of those other women. In chapter 7, we have another sexual encounter between Solomon and the Shulamite. This time they are clearly a more mature couple. They seem more at ease with each other, as we would expect them to be. They seem to take a trip out of the country to be alone together. In chapter 7, verses 11 to 13, the end of the chapter. But I want to point out one more thing, and then we'll begin to make some applications. In chapter 8, and verse 8, it says, "We have a little sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will barricade her with planks of cedar." Now the Shulamite speaks, "I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who finds peace." So here are some who are concerned about a young girl and how to keep her sexually pure. She has no breasts, he says in verse 8. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? So she's going to grow up. She's going to mature. How do we keep her from becoming sexually impure in that time? They say in verse 9, if she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. In other words, if she is a wall, if she repels young men and their advances toward her, then we're going to build a battlement. We're going to make it even harder. We're going to help her and encourage her in that effort. But, second part of verse 9, if she is a door, we will barricade her with planks of cedar. The door is the image of someone who will let anyone in, and so she will freely give herself to anyone. And if our little girl is like that, then we're going to stop her from being that way. We're going to barricade the door so that she doesn't give herself up before marriage. And the Shulamite says in verse 10, "I was a wall." She kept herself pure. And she says, "My breasts were like towers. They were inaccessible." She was one who was focused on purity before marriage. And so she says at the end of verse 10, "Then I became in his eyes as one who finds peace." Because of her purity, she found peace in her husband. And I need to say very clearly, remaining pure before marriage will bless your marriage. So what is the lesson that we need to learn from this book? The lesson is the joy of married love. Even in a marriage like this one, where it could be there was not much falling in love as much as arrangement by Solomon, deep love is still possible. and deep love brings tremendous joy. Your love is better than wine, they both say. It is intoxicating, it is exciting, it is pleasing. And it wasn't just that way for her. Solomon said he delighted in his wife. Chapter 4 and verse 10, he says, your love is better than wine. We're talking here about romance and love. Not just taking care of each other. Not just being what we should be for each other. There is a place in marriage for deep delight and joy in each other. Beyond that, what we see here is in married love, there is a sense of possession. You belong to me. Look in chapter 2 of the song in verse 16. Chapter 2 and verse 16, my beloved is mine and I am his. In chapter 6 and verse 3, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. Do you see that? On either side. She understands I'm his, he's mine, we belong to one another. She says, my garden is his, my fruit is his, I belong to him. Now this is a principle that the Bible teaches regarding the body and the sexual needs we have for one another. In this passage in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 4, Paul says, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. So that principle does exist. We belong to one another. But it seems to me that the sense here is much deeper than simply the body. There is a sense of expecting the affections and attentions of my mate will belong only to me. There is a singular focus, a singular loyalty, a singular commitment. That is the characteristic of married love, according to the Bible. Now, if Solomon and the Shulamite were able to express this, despite him having hundreds of wives, then how much more can we expect that God will demand from us when he tells us we have one mate for life? We need to have this sense of possession that we are already spoken for and that our mate belongs to us. And this deep affection, this attachment to our mate leads to separation anxiety. You remember the dream in chapter 3 where she loses her mate, her beloved. She can't find him, and then she goes out and she says, I cannot let him go. In chapter 5, she goes out and she goes to the watchman. She goes everywhere searching for her beloved. Where is he? To be separated brings torment and agony. God expects marriage to be that way. To be a bond of such strength and intimacy that we cannot stand to be apart from that person. Something is missing and lacking when we are not with our mate. I don't mean every second we're not together. But when we're apart for an extended time, it's something where we feel we're missing something vital. Look in chapter 8 of the song. I believe we have here in chapter 8 the moral of the song. In chapter 8 and verse 6, it says, put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. Love is as strong as death. It pulls and holds on to the one loved. Here he links love with jealousy too. Jealousy is a passionate demand that this one be ours alone. And he says here, that flame, that connection, cannot be quenched, it cannot be separated, and it cannot be bought off. You see, that's the love we read about in a tremendous book like the Song of Solomon. There is a tremendous joy and a power that is present in married love. Well, I want to close by giving a few practical suggestions from the book, and then the lesson will be yours. The first is, I can't read this book without seeing the emphasis God places on keeping ourselves pure before marriage. So keep yourself pure before marriage. There is joy in married love. And while this book makes it clear, it also makes clear the danger of attempting to indulge that beforehand. It doesn't work. Now, sex has a proper and beautiful place within the marriage relationship, but out of context, it is cold and clinical. In marriage, sex is an expression of a deep relationship that is rooted in love. But outside marriage, sex is just sex. Two people acting on lust. And as we read, there will be a blessing to those who keep pure and who make their bodies inaccessible until marriage. So in the words of the song, don't be a door, be a wall. And be sure you don't defile yourself before marriage. Secondly, don't be selfish in marriage. There will come a time in marriage where more than likely we will begin to take our mate for granted. And we need to be very careful not to do this and not to act on selfish impulses. Let's go back to chapter 5 and let me remind you of this. Chapter 5 and verse 3. You remember Solomon comes to the door and wants her to get up and let him in, and she says, I have taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I dirty them again? You see, she's only thinking of herself. She won't act to help even her beloved. Now, likely, she would have done this while they were courting, but not now. She was all about the other person during dating time, but not now. I'm busy. I've got things to do. I don't want to get up. And so often that becomes the rule in our marriages. Things that we used to do with joy, now we refuse to do because we're selfish. Selfishness is the enemy of happiness in our homes. Especially, let me remind husbands that we are commanded to love wives as Christ loved the church. Sacrificially, not selfishly. So consider why you do the things you do in marriage. Consider why you do the things you do to your mate. Don't be selfish. A third lesson, I believe one of the great lessons of this book, is that we need to compliment and communicate. We have the power to make our mate happy with our words. When our mate is insecure, we can reassure them. We can express our love in such a way that we comfort and even excite our mate. Now, when you read these descriptions, they are descriptions of people who are beautiful, far surpassing what we would consider ourselves to be. But I sincerely doubt that either of these people were as perfect as the descriptions we read here. But these were their thoughts about one another. Can't we tell our mates how much we adore and appreciate them? And if we do, won't that strengthen them? Won't that help them tell us? Won't that bless our marriages? Compliment and communicate, and it will be a blessing to you. Not talking about flattery here. Not talking about buttering someone up to get something. We're talking about sincerely expressing our love for one another. Again, I have to say, men especially, who struggle sometimes with communicating our feelings, we need to be willing to tell our wives how much we appreciate and love them, and to compliment and communicate with them. And the final thing I'd like to say is that we need to keep the fire burning. If the love of a marriage grows cold, it is our fault. It will take work, but we have control over this relationship. If we've been selfish, we can stop. If we have problems, we can resolve them, being willing to change. But there is no circumstance and no person that can force us to abandon marital love. Romantic love is the fuel for a marriage. And this book teaches us to continue to stoke those fires even long after the initial joys of marriage give way to selfishness and busyness, and we grow more comfortable with one another. So don't let the fire die. And the problems of life will simply be obstacles that you face with the love of your life. I hope this study has helped you to understand a very difficult book and an overlooked book. I'm happy to study further with you if you have any questions about anything we've talked about. And if you have questions about what I believe is the right interpretation of this, if you have an objection to that or other things, I'm happy to study with you. I'm not saying this is the definitive word. I want to take this moment to offer to you the invitation of the Lord. We haven't spoken about what you need to do to become a Christian, but if there is someone here who's ready to give their life to Jesus, to give up sin and to follow after Him, you're ready to come tonight and to be baptized into Christ. We stand ready to help you as we stand and sing to encourage you.